Shall I?
Yeah.
Sorry. Apologies. I just want to kind of give you the how we're going to organize this. We're going to have a discussion, Roger and I. I will invite him to speak about. I think basically we would like to talk more about his recent book, which is available available for sale here and in other places, Poisoned Well, to reflect on it. And then we're going to have a brief a conversation and for about 40 or 45 minutes, and then we'll open the door for the floor.
Could you speak up a bit, please?
Sorry, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
So we're going to have 40 to 45 minutes of a conversation, and I will invite Roger right now to... to give us an idea about, or give us an introduction to his latest book. Roger, please.
Good. Can you all hear me at the back?
Yeah.
Yeah. Shout out if you, or wave your hands if you lose me or I lose you. Well, thank you for the introduction. Thank you, Mosaic Rooms. Thank you, Dina. And thank you to all of you for coming along this evening. Memory can speak truth to power. Do you remember this line?
I do.
This is a very memorable sentence from Dina's book, What It Means to be Palestinian. And it occurred to me that if I had to choose a kind of slogan or summation of the discussion this evening, that would be it. And I'll come back to this in a moment. Memory can speak truth to power. I think it's a wonderfully suggestive phrase. And if the strongest example I can think of to illustrate the idea behind that sentence comes from the days when I was young. In September 1983, something very unusual happened on the BBC. Quite late at night, on BBC Two, a Palestinian woman whom I knew very well, called Leila Mantoura, stood before the camera. It was not a complicated program. It was one woman standing in front of the camera, and she described how she had gone back home to her home in Jerusalem. She knocked on the door. A woman answered, and perhaps surprisingly, let her in. And once inside, Leila saw her own furniture, her own carpets on the floor, even her own piano. Now, perhaps one should say straight away, was Leila typical? Did she represent Palestinians? In many ways, she didn't. She was middle class. She was been a middle class Palestinian in Jerusalem, and she was now a businesswoman in London. She could speak articulate English to whatever the audience was, and I don't really know what it was, fairly late at night on BBC Two. Not many Palestinians have been able to go back. She had gone back. You can easily imagine that somebody would have gone back in the same circumstances, and the person would have slammed the door in their face and said, go away, or would have said, I don't... I have a whole host of reasons why they wouldn't speak to her. But leaving all that aside, I thought then this was the simplest and most effective statement of the Palestinian case that I could imagine. And I still think that today. Why? It probably doesn't need me to say it. The audience could identify without difficulty with a woman who was saying, and it was so simple, this had been my house, my home, and it is now somebody else's house, somebody else's home. I think I had this well into the back of my mind when, as I was about to leave the World Service of the BBC, I had it in my mind to write a book about the end of empire in the Middle East and the legacies of empire in the Middle East. It's an ambitious book because it takes in 10 countries from North Africa to Southern Arabia. So the chapter on Palestine under British rule is one chapter of 10. The book is doubly ambitious because I wanted, as far as I could, to humanize the story, to bring it to life by using oral history. I can't remember how many memoirs I read. I found the most obscure memoirs of people who'd been in the Middle East from roughly a period of roughly half a century was my given period, from First World War until, let's say, 1917 till 1967, by which time the British and French empires in the Middle East essentially didn't exist anymore. That was pretty much the end of the story. Before talking about Palestinian sources, which I think is our main theme this evening, let me say two things. I'm not presenting my book as some kind of model as to how oral history should be done. I tried to use oral history as a journalist trying to write popular history about this period. I'm sure it can be done better, and I'm absolutely sure that the method worked much better in some chapters than in others. In some, how do you write the oral history of the birth of Saudi Arabia? With huge difficulty, if that's the way you want to write it. You can read the memoirs of St. John Philby or something, but if you want to get beyond the role of a few British figures and a few of the Arabs who worked with Ibn Saud, Egyptians and so on, who did write memoirs, but it's pretty thin gruel, as my old dad used to say. It's an attempt, and it set me thinking about some of the themes that I think we're going to be discussing this evening. Oral history has its limitations. Are people telling the truth? What are the reasons why they write a memoir or a diary? How far can you check what they're saying? Sometimes it's almost impossible to check what they're saying, even if they appear to be contradicting the sort of kind of dominant narrative of what happened. But the rewards seem to me to outweigh the disadvantages. So I don't, in my view, I cast a very wide net. I don't neglect the oral history, the eyewitness accounts by imperialists, and I don't neglect or reject eyewitness accounts by the Zionists. I think all sources have to be treated with some degree of critical detachment, and you have to question the sources. But we can learn much from British accounts, and we can learn much from Zionist accounts. That's my view, anyway. The fact remains, nevertheless, and this is the basic problem, I think, that we need to confront. It's as if there is a Palestinian narrative. Let me rephrase this. It's as if there is a Palestine narrative, but not a Palestinian narrative. The three sides of the so-called Palestinian triangle, the British, the Zionists, and the Arabs, has always been a very, very unequal, imbalanced, wobbly triangle, if you see it as a sort of musical triangle. The three legs are not equal. It's not that, and I think Dina may have things to say about this, it's not that there was no Palestinian narrative, but it's what you and others have called a hidden narrative, a largely hidden narrative. Palestinians were, so to speak, telling one another about the narrative, from grandfather to father, and from father to son and daughter, and so on and so on. It's not as if the narrative wasn't there, but for someone like me coming at the issue, wanting to talk about the mandate, a very particular period, the absolutely formative period in the fullest, and in this case the most tragic sense, you want as many dimensions to the story as you can get. And when you read what is essentially, it's almost as if the story is written by Balfour and Ben-Gurion. I don't mean jointly. You know what I mean? There's an Anglo narrative, there's a British narrative of what happened, there's a Zionist narrative. The British narrative, though, it starts with almost triumphalism. You know, Allenby, that famous picture, Allenby marching into Jerusalem, 1917. And it ends in, from a British point of view, absolute failure. Humiliating failure for Britain and for the British Empire, which still meant something to a lot of British people in 1948. The three sides of the triangle, a British historian once said, 1948 was a Jewish triumph, an Arab tragedy, and a British failure. So the historiography from each of the three sides tends to reflect this. Now, luckily for everybody concerned, historians, and luckily for Palestinians also, this absence or marginalization of the Palestinian narrative, or narratives, we should say, there's never one narrative only. This has started to change. And this is the nature of the change, and is one of the things I think we're going to discuss. But I would say it's only gradually begun to change. When I was preparing my remarks for this evening, I reckoned I knew of about 15 Palestinian memoirs, and all sorts of qualifications can be added here. I don't mean that's all there are, but are available in English. Some of them were written in English by Palestinians in exile. Some were then translated. Why do I narrow the field in that way? That means they have some chance, as I would argue, of entering the historiography, of reaching beyond the Palestinian families who may have heard these stories as oral, as literally oral history, word-of-mouth history. And of those 15, most of them start to come in into the narrative, so to speak, in the 1990s. But with limitations. They're not, by and large, published by big mainstream publishers. A few of them, particularly in the United States, where this is, I think, fairly easy to do, some of them are self-published or very tiny. You can find many of them on Amazon, but they were not reviewed in, you know, the Sunday Times. They were not reviewed in the Spectator. So they exist, but how far are they known? If I haven't gone on, I've gone on quite a long time. I want to say two sort of political or even geopolitical things about what made the Palestine chapter different for me, because there are things that you, Dino, or the rest of you may want to comment on, but they struck me very forcefully. The chapter on Palestine was distinct as far as I was concerned, for several reasons, but first and foremost, because in the case of Palestine, the responsibility of imperialism for creating a problem that has lasted until today, and I'm sorry to say will last well beyond today, could not be clearer. It's slightly harder. I mean, some people will do it to say the French are responsible for all the problems of Lebanon and Syria. But they're not responsible in quite the full and direct historical sense. I mean, Britain created the Palestine problem. And this is not a controversial statement. I don't know any British diplomat, for example, either in office as a diplomat or retired, who's ever sought to contradict this. They just have to live with it. They don't like the fact, and that, you know, the Balfour Declaration, whose centenary we have later this year, is always thrown into their face. You British gave Palestine to the Zionists. So, if I use the metaphor in my title, it was in Palestine more than anywhere else that Britain poisoned the well. my title. I mean, one or two people thought I meant oil wells. I said the poison well. It wasn't the uppermost in my mind. Imperialism poisoned the well, and the place above all other places that it poisoned in the Middle East was in Palestine, because Britain's responsibility was so direct. You know, there's no real argument about it, and it's been so long-lasting. The only other point I've made, and I'm astonished that this is not written about more, but this is one of the keys to why Palestine caused the British such problems and has remained this apparently intractable problem today. It's precisely because there were three parties. If you think about it, with the British in Egypt, there were two main parties, the British and the Egyptians. And the British eventually leave, and the Egyptians become an independent state. Same in Syria, same in Iraq. There's only one other case apart from Palestine where there are three parties and where this complicates the whole game. This gentleman's nodding his head. Do you know what I'm referring to?
Well, it should be Ireland.
Well, that opens up another can of baked beans.
Well, it is Ireland.
No, the only other case that I know of, unless anyone can contradict me, is Algeria. With the very, and I'm not aware of anyone who's done a sustained comparison of the three parties in the two different places. I'd love to see it. But with the obvious and absolutely vitally important distinction, which I think tells us something, I really will end when I've just finished this point. In Algeria, the settlers, the colons, lost. In Palestine, the settlers won. We should think about this, not take everything for granted. The fact that the Zionist settler movement, in effect in Palestine, defeated the British, forcing them out, and defeated the Arabs in war, is extraordinary. Is absolutely extraordinary. But to have a conflict with three parties is far more complicated than when you basically have the rulers and the ruled, two main parties, and the balance of power then over time shifts between them sufficiently that the rulers can become, the ruled can become an independent state. Memory can speak truth to power. That's enough from me for the time being.
Well, I don't think it's enough for you, because we have loads of questions. And I think you are very humble about your contribution here, because you do make a very coherent argument, particularly at the end, about the crisis of the state. And somehow, as you say, the Palestinian chapter stands out, because it is really a very interesting chapter. And the sources that Roger uses all throughout, I think I'd like him to speak a bit about the sources and about his argument at the end, and which is something that maybe someone like me, or perhaps some of the some academic or students can take forward and try and either challenge or deal with. But I want you to talk about that argument briefly before I go back to the idea of the Palestinians and representation and Palestinian voice, and ask you a bit further questions around that. So maybe if you just give us a brief kind of, a brief summary of the sources that you used for the book, and then perhaps we begin to ask you questions around the oral history and its contribution to understanding complex situations.
Okay. I'm a typical journalist. I want stories, human stories, but I ideally want them to be unusual, an unusual point of vision, even quirky. And heaven knows, in the story of the modern Middle East, somehow the people attracted to the Middle East over many years have included eccentrics, religious zealots, nutcases, oddballs, military adventurers, not to say mercenaries, plus all sorts of other people who are basically unknown to history. To a certain extent, you have to include, not necessarily with memoirs, but you have to include in the narrative some of the big figures. So, Haji Amin, The Mufti Haji Amin al Husseini, the unchallenged leader, but you know the preeminent leader. Not everybody liked him in Palestine, but the ruler of the Palestinians beyond all, you know, who managed to maintain his grip on the Palestine Arabs, even from exile. He hasn't written much by way of memoirs or diaries. That would be interesting. There were some interviews, but I didn't gain much from them. But he has to be in the narrative. So I try and describe him and bring him alive. His background was not the usual background of a dignitary. But beyond that, far more interesting to me, and I'll give only two examples, I looked at a range of memoirs and looked at figures to see how far I could bring them alive and what they brought to the table, you know, what they added to the story. The big thing is to try and use, to approach a familiar story from an unusual angle of vision. I'll use one very briefly, one British example, but it's not actually in the book. You can find in the history, some of you may know Tom Segev's book, One Palestine Complete. A charming British character who was certainly not imperialist in any full-blooded sense, a woman called Hilda Wilson, who taught at Bir Zeit near Ramallah, and Bir Zeit in those days was a school, not the university that it is today. And she left a fairly long account of teaching there. It's wonderful. Teaching Hamlet to her students and how young Arabs responded to Hamlet. And she would get a lift into Ramallah or into Jerusalem with the British Tommies. "Here, love, what are you doing here? You're teaching them Arab kids." And the whole thing is just lovely. And she puts it all down. She records it, what she said and what they said. And this was during the Great Arab Revolt from 1936 to 39. She knew that some of her own students were running guns or doing something and trying to support something that they all thought was very important, but also for young kids, very exciting. But let me turn to the Palestinians that I identified, first of all. Really significant, because it breaks so many molds, is, I think, the memoir of Fadwa Tuqan. In English, they've called it A Mountainous Journey. She was became very famous as a Palestinian poet. But the memoir describes, and this is how I put it in the book, which to me is so fascinating, some of the social history, in my view, has to be there, even if you're not really writing a social history of the Middle East. So the role of women, the position of women. She's from the Tuqan family is hugely influential and wealthy in Nablus, in what we now call the West Bank. But Nablus is a very conservative city. In many ways, women from peasant families had more freedom of movement in the fields working than she did. She and her mother only left the house to go to the hammam, the Turkish bath. Servants did the shopping. When she tries to write poetry, her father punishes her harshly. She writes poetry under the guidance and help and moral support of her husband, who was a significant poet. Her brother, her elder brother, who was a very significant poet, Ibrahim Tuqan. So as I put it in the book, her story of personal liberation becomes entwined with the story of national liberation, or rather the quest for both of those. As we know, national liberation didn't come. And the two, in other words, her political awareness and her sense of wanting to be a woman who could write poetry. Her brother went off to AUB, American University of Beirut. Why couldn't she? She couldn't. She's born, by the way, in the year of the Balfour Declaration, which makes it easy to remember. So she's growing up in the 1920s, in the very early years of the Mandate. I'll only mention other examples, and then if any people are interested, we can look more at them. But in total contrast with Fadwa is the memoir by someone I knew very well, in the 1980s, as I was getting going as a journalist, Jabra, Ibrahim Jabra. It's a very poignant account. It's called The First Well, A Bethlehem Boyhood. And it meant a lot to me because I knew Jabra as this extremely cultivated guy who translated Shakespeare into Arabic. He translated Dylan Thomas into Arabic, which I find absolutely impossible to comprehend. He was an art critic, he was an artist himself, he was a poet, he was a novelist. When I visited him in Baghdad, the Baghdad of Saddam Hussein, his home was this oasis of culture and stimulation and art and literature and everything. And he grew up in Bethlehem in abject poverty. So the contrast between Fadwa Tuqan and this young barefoot boy, you know, chasing lizards and climbing trees in the fields around Bethlehem. I think the only thing I'll add is that overtly, explicitly, it's not a political book at all. And yet, why did he write it? And it's, you see, he's writing about not only a lost boyhood, he's writing about a paradise lost. The book is lyrical. It's and of course, the lyricism is poignant because he's describing everything that's gone. And this is what, nothing would exemplify better what I mean, what I think Dina meant by the phrase, memory can speak truth to power. He didn't need to write it as an attack on the British or an attack on the Zionists. That's taken as read. That's what happened. I'm writing this book because that was my boyhood. That was the most important part of my life. He wrote it in old age. He was quite unwell. He had to write that book, which I found had to get it out. And luckily, he entrusted it to his old friend, still alive in Canada, Issa Bulata, who translated it very well into English. They're just two examples, but I wanted people who were not the Mufti, were not high figures in politics, and yet who could shed light. I hope a new light on the story.
Thank you, Roger. I just wanted to add, if Rada Karmi was here, she would be talking again about her father's contribution, Hassan Karmi, who was really an amazing man, and he was with the BBC, as well as my father as well, and they all really were kind of very much influenced by this need to engage with society in different ways. But I wanted to ask you, again, go back to the question about you. You say that there is a change in contributions, but it is a very small change in contributions to understanding history through oral history and through memories and through these kind of personal accounts that can be very evocative but also very informative. But what I wanted to ask is a kind of provocative question, which is, do you think that the Palestinians themselves have been complicit in the marginalization, in the sense that they have not been very much engaged with telling stories about themselves? And if so, why?
It's interesting. You, as a Palestinian, are being quite tough to Palestinian society. I think we should remember it was very hard to get those narratives out. I'll mention two exceptions. I mean, I looked at my 14 or 15 memoirs all came out since 1990. Fadwa Tuqan's, the English version, came out in 1990. So whatever it is, 25 years ago, 26 years ago. There are two Palestinian accounts from the 60s, and they were published by mainstream publishers, which I find quite strange. And friends told me a little bit about both of them when I asked them. One is what amounts to an autobiography by Musa Alami, one of the most interesting of the political figures. You know, and they tended to be, you know, he, like George Antonius, was Cambridge educated. He could talk to the British. They dealt with him. And you find the papers, the things that they wrote, officials to Antonius, and you find them all in Oxford, where I live now, at the Middle East Centre. But it wasn't written directly by Musa Alami. It was written by his British friend, Geoffrey Furlong, And apparently Furlong sat him down and there were long tapes. And I'm not entirely comfortable with the fact that the story is mediated by a British official. I think he had good intentions. It's called, you know, Palestine is my country. And in 1967, 1968, this was pretty unusual. But a book that says nothing about Alami's relations with the Mufti, and we know he was loyal to the Mufti, but at a certain point they fell out. I mean, this, I'm sorry, this is... I want candid accounts. And the one thing I would say to Palestinian friends is if we expect, even demand, of the British and the Zionists that they confront dark pages in their history, we have to ask Palestinian Arabs also to confront, if not dark pages, awkward pages. Some Palestinians sold land to the Zionists. This is a fact. And some of them went publicly and said, we mustn't sell land to the Zionists, and then privately sold land to the Zionists. Complete hypocrisy. And then the problem of leadership. You know, one, it's easy to argue, but possibly necessary to say that, I don't know, maybe it doesn't need to be said. Palestinians, on the whole, have been badly led from the beginning until now. It's very hard if we talk about the top leadership. I think Palestinians do confront that question. I don't think the leadership is a taboo issue. There may be certain constraints among certain people. But the sale of land, which of course is still sensitive to families now, and they'll say, oh, what's the source? Thomas Segev names some of them using the Zionist documentation. But the fact that the Zionists produced lists of visitors doesn't by itself prove that this was false. What motive would the Zionists have in their own documents, in their own archives, to say that X was selling? I won't name families now. But Segev caused some embarrassment, I think, by mentioning prominent families. But the one thing I think I want to give a better answer to your question, if I can. I am being very picky in one sense by looking at memoirs that, as I've put it, have begun to enter the historiography. Oh, by the way, I'm very digressive as a speaker. I'm sorry. The second one in 1968 was A Bedouin Boyhood, Isaac Dik, who grew up in a tribe just north of the Gaza Strip. And people told me, now this was reviewed in the Sunday Times, that Musa Alami's book was published by John Murray, Deke's book was published by one of the main, I don't know, Chatham, I can't remember, a mainstream publisher. And I asked friends, why did it have an impact at the time? They said, because it was simple and direct, and it showed that for Bedouin too, 1948 meant the break, rupture with the home and the land. And for Bedouin, the land has a significance. It may be a somewhat different significance than it might be from an urban dweller. So to me it's a slight oddity that in the 60s, the late 60s, these two books appear with mainstream publishers and to some, I'm not sure I'd say acclaim, but they had some effect. So what happened in between? I think to cut the long story short, Palestinians become stereotyped all too easily in not only in the media, but in the political discourse and then in popular imagination, as the ultra-passive stereotype, the refugee, or the hyper-active stereotype, the gunman, the hijacker of planes, the blower, you know, the image of Palestine in a terrorist, quote-unquote. And mainstream publishers shut their doors to this. Now, having said that, I think it's very important to add that in addition to the relatively small number of books I've mentioned, with the limitations, small publishers, by the way, most of them, these memoirs are by men, and most of these men are from either Jerusalem or Jaffa. I mean, it's not surprising, the two main cities in Palestine, but these are limitations too. But think now about something that we haven't mentioned at all, and we may not touch on, but we should be aware of, what's happening online. Mm-hmm. Young Palestinians now are setting up websites. They're interviewing, for many purposes, the Palestinian story, the narrative doesn't stop at 1948. I discovered one I should have known about recently, put together by Karma Nabulsi and her colleagues. She's coming here on the 18th of May. We're talking about the Balfour Declaration. I shall try to come. But there's a whole mass of websites, some of which I barely know, on the Nakba, on Palestinian, on everything you could think of. And this is hugely important because you don't need a mainstream publisher to do this. And on your Facebook page, you can link people to these various things. Now, this is entirely new. So I think, on the whole, Palestinians suffered from a sense of blockage. You know, people often refer to the infamous Golda Meir statement, "Who are the Palestinians? They don't exist." People seldom use the full quote, by the way. You should get it. She's clear. She doesn't mean they don't physically exist. She's politically, they're of no account. Who the hell are they? They don't matter. That's what she's saying. But that view was widespread all over the place for quite a long time, and only began to change, in my view, for absolutely straightforward political reasons. The rise of the Israeli right with Begin, Shamir, Nabul, Sharon, Sabra and Shatila, the first intifada, public opinion begins to change. Publishers follow on, often a bit slowly, from public opinion. And look at it today. If you're a Palestinian woman and novelist, you have a much better chance. I wouldn't say it's easy to get published, but you have a much, much better chance than you would have had in the 70s or probably the 80s. There's almost a trend for, you know, third world literature, and the public opinion about Palestine in my lifetime, and I'm not 100 years old, has changed hugely, and I think this has impacted on the issues we're talking about.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I know we are almost coming to the end of the conversation, but I think, and then we'll open up for questions. But quickly, I just, you know, the idea of oral history as a credible source for remembering and for memory and for kind of complementing, you know, other forms of history writing. One way that when I started writing my book, I was looking at examples of oral history. And the examples I was looking at were by actually former journalists or journalists in the United States who were writing about the marginalized. You know, we're trying to get the stories of the marginalized, and this kind of was a very empowering feeling in a sense. You know, if you're going to try and speak to people whose voice has not made it to the mainstreams, to try and see whether you could actually talk to them and get another alternative. But I really wanted to ask you a bit more about your sources, because it struck me as I was writing, yes, you do have the Arab sources as well, but you also have these memoirs by visitors to Palestine, by diplomats and so on. There was some amazing stuff there. So I just wanted you to kind of engage with that a little bit in terms of the balance, or in terms of the way that you put it together. And it's such a great read. You know, you could read it at one go without even stopping. It's really a good read. So do
one of the very nice moments. I mean, authors often have very tricky relations with their publishers. And my publisher was looking through the fourth draft or the fifth draft, and he said, you know, to my colleague's great surprise, I was sometimes laughing aloud. So I said to him, oh, you mean a lot of your authors make you weep? That's what you really mean. But the story as a whole is very grim. Imperialism is not a bundle of laughs, but we can laugh at the imperialists, the ridiculous protocol of Government House in Jerusalem, the fancy dress, say, all war. To our eyes in 2017, this is all very ridiculous, especially because we know that it all ends in tears. But we have the advantage over those who lived through it in that sense. But as a journalist, I'm quite indulgent about using journalists maybe more so than scholars would. I'd be surprised if any of you, especially if you haven't read the book, have even heard of, she was then a young British journalist called Barbara Board, B-O-A-R-D. I know about her because I've had long correspondence with her daughter, who is publishing, is trying to get published some of the unpublished material that her mum left. And Barbara Board was a journalist reporting from Palestine for 10 years, from about mid-30s to mid-40s, filing for the Daily Sketch and other British newspapers. I don't say that journalists, especially writing for papers of that kind, are the greatest source we have, but she wrote these other manuscripts, which her daughters she found in a proverbial suitcase under the bed when her mum died. And one of my happiest finds, in a way, you nodded your head when I said Barbara Board, that makes you very unusual. Have any of you in the room heard in the Palestine context of Richard Stubbs, Dick Stubbs? Stubbs, you know, God save his grace, was the spin doctor, was the British spin doctor in Palestine. Of course, he didn't use that term then. And of all the lousy jobs, after the Second World War, those last dark years, 1945 to 1948, everybody hated the British. American media hated them, Zionist media hated them, the Arab media hated them, and they were doing, when Stubbs arrived, a lousy job at public relations. And he gets back from Palestine, and wisely he writes his memoir then and there while it's fresh in his mind. Big virtue. But he publishes it privately. I found it in the library, quite by chance, in the library of the Arab British Centre. And then, I'm a serious researcher, I drove out to Suffolk to meet a friend of his. You know, you use the internet, you put one thing together, and I pieced together the life of Richard Stubbs. And just to show you some of the emotions aroused by this, he had, because he knew a lot of the photographers, he was the chief censor, by the way, also. He tried to stop the infamous pictures of the British sergeants hanging from trees that had been killed by the Irgun. He tried to stop those pictures getting out, and he thought he had the means. He was the spin doctor and the censor. The last thing he wanted was that they should appear in British living rooms. The Daily Express got them and splashed them on the front page. A picture that shocks the world, real time. And it was a shocking picture. And in its way, it helped to push the British out because public opinion couldn't stand this anymore. And so you get the inside story from Stubbs about how he failed to stop the picture getting out. On the cover of his book, he puts a map of Greater Israel and a hand. And you look at the back, and the hand is the actual hand of Menachem Begin. Now I know this to be true, but what emotion was going through this man's head? What animated him most about Palestine after all this experience? Putting it crudely, who did he hate most? He hated Begin. And the groups who'd blown up the King David Hotel in 1946, killing many of his friends, Stubbs' friends. The people who'd given them hell. Their two great devils for the British were Truman administration in the United States and the Irgun and the Stern Gang in Palestine. And between them, this is the British narrative now. We can comment on it, we can deal with it critically, but this, from their point of view, they were squeezed and bullied and, you know, bruised from without, from the United States, and from within, by what the Zionists called the dissident groups, and what the British called terrorists. To me, that's fascinating. The narrative that we want to produce should not be dominated, I think, by the British and the Zionist sources. That's my starting point. But when they have something to tell us, and maybe even something new, if not factually new, a new angle of vision on a story that's been written about so many times, I always say Palestine is overwritten about, over-argued about, over everything. You know, every kind of excess applies to the Palestine story. Maybe we should open up to these good people who are sitting patiently here.
Okay. I don't thank you for mentioning the quote from the book, but thank you so much. So any questions, please, comments, ideas, just put your hand up and yes, please, go.
Yes, thank you very much. It's fascinating. I myself kind of spontaneously came here because I met this gentleman on the train. I myself am going into international diplomacy, geopolitics for postdoc this year. And Palestine is one of the most interesting, sort of abnormal kind of things that can still exist in this day and age. I just wanted to know, in your opinion, what, I mean, with Trump existing now, I don't want to go too, far away from the oral history, but what do you think of the current situation of Trump and how much of a voice do you think they're going to have?
I'm going to subtly or not very subtly divert your question away. I'm going to come to it, to Trump. But I end the book with Blair. See, the book is about a poisoned, the empire and its legacy, plain language, imperialism and its legacy in the Middle East. And imperialism as a poisonous legacy, a toxic legacy, if you like. The point is that Western intervention didn't begin with the First World War, and it didn't end when the British and the French left the region. Western intervention's gone on for 200 years, from the days of Gladstone and Disraeli to the days of Tony Blair, and if you will, to the days of Donald J. Trump. Because I try to squeeze a whole load of things in the epilogue, which takes the story more or less from the end of empire to the Arab Spring. Because to my mind, and I've been challenged on this, but I stick with my view, in a way, I have to say it again, in a way the Arab Spring was a kind of rerun of the independence struggle. Never mind the great gap in time and the fact that the whole world had changed in the meantime. Arabs in, let's say, Egypt were saying, we thought we'd won independence from the wicked European imperialists. But what we got was a phony independence which didn't give us anything which Abdel Nasser and the other nationalist leaders had promised us. And now we've got to try again. We've got to do it again, and we've got to do it better this time, and it's got to be a genuine independence with at least some of the things that we've always wanted and never stopped wanting from the 1950s until now. And the other point of comparison is that, as with the Arab Spring, you get, so with the moment of independence in the 50s, 60s in the case of Algeria, you get a moment, a glorious moment of popular empowerment and optimism. And it doesn't last. Either in a brief period of time or over years, it ends with what I call a kind of independence fatigue. I haven't said a word about Trump other than mentioning his name.
No, it was more the general.
Do we think? I mean, yesterday he met Mahmoud Abbas. I mean, good luck to you, Mr. Abbas. I don't know what he said to you. Mahmoud Abbas was quite astonishingly polite to him under the circumstances. But in a sense, if I was in Mr. Abbas's situation, I wouldn't go and shout at him or badmouth him or peel off my Free Palestine T-shirt. I mean, what do you want? Do you want to think that you want to test out whether this guy with this very big mouth is going to do anything? I don't think he will do a damn thing. The guy at the back is very keen
to
catch
our
attention.
I'd like to put two points to the speaker. Firstly, it's very easy to blame British imperialism for the plight of Palestine yesterday and today. And Britain certainly does have a heavy burden of blame to bear. But wasn't the British Empire in itself colonised and exploited and used by a higher, more powerful empire, that of Zionist Jewry, who manipulated Britain, particularly in its darkest hours in 1917, was able to use the money power to get what Zionist Jewry wanted, and therefore just obeying British imperialism is a little bit superficial. Secondly, you're talking about oral history. Oral history is all very well and good, but what about actual documented history? Is the speaker aware that documents at Kew, which are supposed to be protected archives, have been in recent years systematically weeded by Sayanin, and that the government is aware of the fact that important documents bearing on Israeli activity before and after so-called Israeli independence and on matters such as Dimona have been weeded from our archives? Does our speaker have any knowledge of that? And what pressure is being put to stop the theft of our memory of these things?
I missed one crucial word.
Okay. Let's have the speaker answer.
You said the weeding of the archives by, and what was the key word?
Sayanin, the helpers. Mossad's helpers.
Mossad's helpers. You have a point. I'm quite happy to be challenged by you. I really am. You have a point, but you've overdone it. That's my short answer to you. The Zionists, particularly under Weizmann, I mean the consummate string puller, the consummate networker, as we would say nowadays, the man who in many ways helped to bring about the Balfour Declaration was Chaim Weizmann. He played the Lloyd George government. He played Arthur Balfour. He played the young Winston Churchill like a violin. It is astonishing. And when he didn't like officials in Palestine, civil or military, he got them removed. Not every time, but in a large number. He was more likely to get people removed that he wanted removed than not. But you have to see how the story changes. If Zionist manipulation was so brilliant and lasted all the way through, why did the British, on the eve of the Second World War, issue the White Paper, which made the Zionists absolutely furious, because it said, basically, there'll be an independent, bi-national Palestine in 10 years, Jewish immigration will be reduced, and Jewish land purchases will be reduced, and that the Arabs would have some kind of say, or even veto, I can't remember the exact word, over land sale and over immigration. The Zionists said, Ben-Gurion's absolutely furious, as you perhaps know, and felt that the whole Balfour Declaration promised by the British had been torn up. And the answer is that the Zionists were extremely effective at the early crucial stage. I mean, without the Balfour Declaration, we wouldn't be here today telling this story. I think it was the sine qua non. But when they could no longer get what they wanted from the British, and when Weizmann was in decline, and the much more aggressive, let's say, Ben-Gurion was on the rise, they switched horses from the declining British power to the rising American power. So I don't think you can say in those terms that British imperialism was systematically exploited from beginning to end, from 1917 to 1948, by the Zionists. You have a point, I repeat, but it's not quite as straightforward as you said. On the weeding of documentation, I do not know the ins and outs. I know that all sorts of things are either weeded out or are redacted, which means black blobs are put over sensitive things or over names. I do know that in some cases, I do know that there's a variety of reasons why this might happen. Governments, including our own and the American government, were on the whole slow to admit that their two intelligence services had overthrown the popular elected prime minister of Iran in 1953. Certain secrets remain not wholly secret because things come out, and various reasons will be given, usually national security, and then you have to ask yourself whether this is a genuine reason or just a useful camouflage. The notion that Mossad or something is entering Kew and dictating this process, I find a bit hard to credit, to be frank.
Oh, yes, please. Yeah.
Going back to the topic of the evolution of the Palestinian narrative over time. You alluded to the point that even within your own lifetime, the perception from the West has changed towards...
From Europe has changed.
From Europe has changed towards towards this this hidden narrative. In the context of today and where this could evolve in the future, so I'm from Lebanon, and we've had in recent years a quote-unquote more urgent refugee crisis from Syria. And often in the context of Lebanon and in the context of my community, I feel like there's a bit of a competition almost for airtime over the more urgent, more urgent because of the timeline of events, more recent maybe, crisis. So I just wanted to hear from you if you had any comments about how this narrative, especially in the context of refugees, could evolve, given how fast moving things have been in terms of numbers of movements of people that almost present day humanitarian problems.
I think you have a point, and we use all sorts of, frankly, rather unlovely terms, you know, humanitarian fatigue, refugee fatigue, or, I mean, to be even blunter, you know, sort of Palestine fatigue. And there are lots of people, including journalists and politicians, and enough. Do you want me to ruin my career by going into that? I mean, this is a slightly different set of motivation, but it's another kind of fatigue or inertia, and it's horrible. To me, the only answer to this, this may not be very satisfying to you, but is to take the longer view. The Palestinians, compared with the other Middle Eastern peoples in my book, Egyptians, Iraqis, whatever, have so few weapons, I mean that in the broadest possible sense, so few instruments, levers at their disposal, have so much against them, not least on the ground, as what the remnants of Palestine are eaten up on an almost daily basis. Taking the long view means what levers do you have? And my answer is that there are two, and that they relate. We can relate them to each other if we're smart. One is public opinion, and the other is the narrative, or what I call memory. Let's just unpack it. I've used the term two or even three times. Memory can speak truth to power. We know whose memory we're talking about. Who is the power? Memory can speak truth to the British power, the Israeli power, the Western and American power, especially in a globalized age. It's not, I don't want to overrate this. You know, one would wish that the Palestinians would have many other things at their disposal. One would genuinely wish this if their situation is to materially change. But in the kingdom of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. You have to start from where you are. And in a globalized age, memory has not just its own value, and we should be very clear about this. I remember my own childhood. It's very dear to me, but its meaning is different, its significance is different from the Bethlehem boyhood remembered by Jabir Ibrahim Jabir. But memory also then, apart from its personal value, has its uses, and they're entirely legitimate uses. We're not talking about some sort of exploitation or manipulation here. Because the essence of memory, and there's a phrase that I picked up from Adam Labour's wonderful book, I think, about Jaffa. I was slightly put off when it came out. It's called City of Oranges, and I thought, cliche. You know? I didn't know who he was. Yeah. It's a brilliant evocation of the evolution of Jaffa from sort of Ottoman times until 2006 or so, whenever the book came out. And he takes the memory, in particular, of Hassan Hammami, the Hammami family of Jaffa. Hassan Hammami is still alive in Canada, I think, in his 80s. And he left Jaffa in 1948, and he gets, Adam Labor sits him down, and he describes leaving Jaffa as a kid on the boat with hundreds of other people leaving Jaffa, heading for Beirut. An old man dies on the boat. They run out of food on the boat. A woman gives birth on the boat. The baby dies. Later in life, we have, if the trauma of Exodus isn't bad enough, there's a different kind of trauma, the trauma of return. Because Hassan Hamami becomes successful, like I don't know exactly what he did. He goes back. He goes back to Jaffa. And Adam Labor is virtually sitting with him in the car. And the words come tumbling out of this 70-something-year-old Hassan Hamami. He remembers the old bank, an Ottoman building. He remembers the famous... He sees and remembers the clock tower in Jaffa that was built by Sultan Abdul Hamid. He sees the souk where his grandfather ran a shop. And Labor says, words are not just words. They are an act of affirmation. I'm still here, to put it at its absolute simplest. And the one thing that every Palestinian can say, whatever else is going against them, is, I am here. And part of the implication is that is, to hell with you if you're telling me, like Golda Meir, I don't exist, or that politically I count for nothing and don't really exist in that sense. To hell with you if you're the Western world or the Western media or whoever you are, and my narrative appears to have no... to hold no interest for you. I exist. And as Labor also says, that you can't take away from Hassan Hamami or the other people of Jaffa. You can take away the home. His family home had become a Jewish old people's home. He tries to go in, but I think it's too painful for him to go in. You can take away X, Y, and Z. You can almost strip off the clothes off their back. I still exist. Nobody can take away.
It reminds me of the poem by Mahmoud Darwish, the famous Palestinian poem about, I write, so I exist. So memory, I speak, so I exist. I think you had a question. No? Yeah. Go on.
I was recently at a Welcome Trust event, and people were talking about...
Do you want to speak up? I can hear you, but maybe...
Sorry. I was recently at a Welcome Trust event, it was about false memory and how false memory can arise in accounts, particularly in traumatized situations. So I wonder, when we're looking at some of these accounts, people fleeing under difficult circumstances, whether... in some cases, you felt the accounts were muddled or events were crisscrossed, because we now know the human brain does that under trauma, and there's a lot of research on that. So how do you... and does it matter? It might not matter, because these memories, even if they're slightly false, might still carry a truth.
That's a very, very interesting question. The question is about false memory. To me, I'm looking at memory put in some concrete form. It could be on a tape, but it's more likely to be on a piece of paper in some form or another. And there's a huge distinction for me as a researcher. I'm inclined to say for me as a human being, if you allow me to put it that way, it matters to me whether this is a contemporary account, like a diary, or it was written in 2015, or when the person was getting old and is trying to draw back their memories and so on, which may be fine, but one thing will be obvious. Everything will be coloured by 1948. Whereas, and I must mention here the diaries of Khalil Sakakini. We don't have them in English, but we have a lot of extracts. Like many people probably, I was introduced to Khalil Sakakini in the pages of Tom Segar. Here's an Israeli author, a so-called revisionist historian, who makes Khalil Sakakini one of the main characters, who appears in the book, reappears, builds a new house, his son comes back from America, and so on and so on. And many of you will know this. I think there's work underway in Ramallah with my old friend Salim Tamari and his colleagues to bring about, to translate and publish the full diaries of Khalil Sakakini. An extraordinary, for those of you who don't know, an extraordinary educator and a pretty extraordinary human being. You can't help, I can't help but warm to someone whose calling card said, Khalil Sakakini, a human being, God willing. He was highly progressive as an educator. He was a figure of importance in the Arab national movement in Palestine. And these very long diaries, I mean, sometimes quirky, sometimes, you know, it's full of contradictions. Fascinating. But the immediacy is, I'm writing on the 3rd of April 1937, and I don't know what will happen the next day. And I don't know that he had forebodings about 1948, quite pressing. So that's a, to me, that's a distinction. Because I think most of us know this in our own lives. You remember what you choose to remember. Mm. I sometimes think of memory like a photograph. I can't remember what happened when I was a kid, but I can remember my memory of what happened. Do you see what I mean? It's almost like carbon copy, which is, it's not really what happened. Or in a simple term, someone will say, do you remember that film from the 70s? And I would say, I can't remember a thing about that film except that I didn't like it. See, what? Now why does that stick in the head? You couldn't tell them the plot of the film. The mind, in ways that I think we don't fully understand, hooks on to the thing that it chooses to remember, or perhaps needs to remember, discarding other things. And the memory is sometimes false. Or not, you know, what do we mean, true and false, as if they are black and one is black and one is white? Are not entirely truth, not the full truth, not the whole truth, as they say in a court of law. I'm not expert enough to give you a better answer about false memory. Does it matter? Not necessarily, but a researcher has to look critically at everything. You know, as far as you can. Not accept everything at face value. You look at it at face value, and then it will raise questions to you, for you, almost inevitably.
Yep, yes, please.
Actually, you talked a bit about literature. I mean, you have various autobiographical novels, or you have a novel like Men in the Sun, which was made into a film, you know, a powerful film which is subtitled in English. And then there's a novel that was shortlisted for the International Prize for Arabic Fiction, Rabir Madhoun, which goes a lot into his childhood in Gaza, you know, in the 50s and so on. I mean, how do you see the literature itself and where it overlaps with autobiography
I thought about...
Yeah, go on.
But you may want to answer. I thought about whether it was legitimate to use novel, short story, poem, and when you know that there's a very strongly autobiographical dimension, sometimes an overwhelmingly autobiographical dimension. And my answer to that question is yes. But it's clearly a different sort of source from the memoirs of Fadwa Tuqan in Nablus. And now you mentioned some of the examples. If non-Arabs, non-Palestinians don't know the quite extraordinary story by Ghassan Kanafani called Return to Haifa, you better read it. And summaries of it sometimes don't catch its edge, its hard edge. Basically, a family manages to return to Haifa. They'd lost their baby boy. He's been found, and he's grown up as an Israeli. You know, you begin to bristle, you know, almost something's happening on you as you begin to see the extraordinary premise of this story, and the boy becomes a soldier in the Israeli army. Now, most critics say that Kanafani, being extremely clever and accomplished writer, wants to humanize the Israelis. That's true, but they don't usually add, there's no wishy-washy reconciliation, compromise, let's all live together nicely in some future society. Kanafani was a revolutionary. And the story is a long short story, some people call it a novella. It burns with injustice. And it puts the injustice into concrete form, human form, by this extraordinary premise of going back to Haifa under those circumstances. Now, could I easily use that story in a narrative, a fairly tightly written, concise chapter on the Palestine Mandate? Hard, but I would say to anybody, follow this. I think I put in a footnote, look at Mahmoud Darwish. When he said, the poem, I Am an Arab, he's addressing an Israeli, and I think it's pretty clear from the poem he's addressing an Israeli soldier. I'm here. It's very, very confrontational. I'd also add, and sadly, Soraya Antonius, George Antonius' daughter, died at the beginning of this year, I understand. She wrote two novels set in Mandate Palestine, The Lord, and then Where the Jinn Consult, is this unusual title for the second one. Fascinating, because she was born in Jerusalem and had absorbed from her very accomplished parents. One of the things that's absorbed is actually an Anglophile sentiment. I have no problem with you as human beings. I have no problem with English literature, with Shakespeare and Dickens. I'm happy to write novels in the English language. But you destroyed my life, my family's life, and my country's life. So to talk about, it's not 100% hatred is fairly rare in human affairs, in my view. Deep ambivalence is very common in human affairs. At a certain level, I can get on with you. But Walid Khaledi said he, at the time of Suez, he could not forgive Britain the culture that had produced Dickens and Chaucer and Shakespeare, for the horror, the enormity of what happened in Suez in 1956. You sense the man's pain, because at certain part of his, he's had a quite Anglophile upbringing, and yet Britain has, not for the first time, many Arabs would say, has betrayed them big time. It's almost the sense of a love affair going terribly wrong. It may not be a very precise analogy, but there was something that was not hatred that became bitterness and sense of betrayal and hatred and, how could you do this to me? But writ large, because it's about politics and geopolitics, it's not about a purely personal relationship.
I would like to comment briefly on your question about trauma and so on. In my, so of course, trauma does leave particular effects and memories and so on. But remembering is very subjective. So one thing that we have to know, and there's something I talk about, which is, you know that it's subjective. You know there may be some elements of it that are maybe exaggerated. We all have that. But the interesting thing about Palestinian remembering and memory is the fact that it relates to something that has happened. And this is really important to remember. I mean, there is a context. There's a particular context. Trauma, whatever. But an event that has had an effect on people's lives. And so you cannot forget that in trying to understand what this remembering, whether it's subjective or totally objective, is. And I'll tell you a very funny story. So one of my people I interviewed, a very old lady in Damascus at that time, and very sadly now they all, in Yarmouk camp. She has died since. And I went to see her after the book was published, and I gave her the book because there's a picture of her. And she said, I thought about what I was telling you, and I actually didn't mean to say that about my husband, because he was a nice man. And I said, well, you didn't say anything bad about him. And she said, well, I kind of thought maybe I said something bad. So it was really very strange experience for me, going back and then, okay. But it is very, you know, there's the timing element, the time in which you remember. So it's not also remembering the time, it's also the actual time that you remember things, you know, what is it? And how you kind of, oh, maybe I said something wrong. But that's, you know, part of human nature, and I think it's kind of interesting. But I also agree with Roger here in terms of your question about why don't you include literature and so on. That's a different type of kind of material to use in a book of this kind. So it does have a place, and it does provide a different understanding that is very much needed. But I think, you know, you kind of deal with it, in and your answer to that was excellent. So any more questions, please? Yep, yes, please.
See, my difficulty with memories is that they tend to be passive, meaning, look what they have done to us, poor us. So what feeling do they invoke in the reader is, oh, I'll give him 5 pence and let him be happy. Now, I was one of those 100-odd thousand of Arabs who stayed in Israel after 48. Now, we were in a position where the land, most of our land was expropriated. We were dealt treated as third-degree citizens. Our neighbors considered us to be traitors because we stayed behind. And we had to make a living. And our leaders in those days looked for how, I mean, we know that the military government is bad. We know that we are badly treated, but we need to live. We need to make a life for ourselves. You mentioned Khalil Sakakini. Khalil Sakakini's house was robbed. He had an enormous library, which was stolen. Now, documents were found about all this. Now, I know, in 48, I was 5 years old, ready to go to school, and there was no library in the school, there were no books, there was nothing. Now, we are now about 3 generations hence. We have university professors, we have high court judges, we have lawyers, we have doctors. In 48, there was, in Haifa, there was maybe 1 or 2 lawyers. I can't think of any doctor. School teachers, when I went to school, some of my teachers were Iraqi Jews. Okay, because there were not enough teachers. But the point was all the time is how we are aware of the problems, but how we can solve them. And you mentioned Mahmoud Darwish, and there were other poets who wrote poems of defiance, not for poems of saying, please do feel sorry for me.
Yeah.
Okay, now, about literature. I say the books have gone. The Communist Party issued a literary magazine called Jadid, which people contributed to poetry and prose and what have you. Then they started nicking books from across the border and republishing them. And basically, and the other thing is, which I find incredible, is that those people whose villages were wiped out and they were left destitute, they were put up by other families, and as a consequence, there were no refugee camps inside Israel. I mean, I still look in Gaza and West Bank, there's still refugee camps. In Israel, there were never any refugee camps.
Sorry, can I ask you what the question is? Is it just about, you know, you're just giving...
I'm just saying that my view is that we should look rather than also, not but about memories, what they've done to us, is how we could do for ourselves. Thank you.
I regard that as a contribution rather than a question in a way.
Yeah.
But the only comment I'd make very briefly is memories don't have to be passive. You're referring to a certain type of memory, largely to do with 1948, and that, you know, and it's obviously large numbers of Palestinians will feel this. We've suffered in 1948, and some of them were refugees twice over, and so on. So there's a kind of memory of refugeehood, or victimhood, if you like. Rashid Khalidi once said, "We are victims of victims." Very suggestive phrase. But when I say that, that's only one type of memory, and the example I would give is this lovely memoir that I've referred to, The First World, A Bethlehem Boyhood by Jabra Ibrahim Jabra. It's not bitter. It's not a political polemic. The feelings about the British and the Zionists are all implicit. You have to read them into the story. And the story, you see, this is the Palestine remembered. And Dina's written about this. A tendency maybe to romanticize the past, but to my mind a forgivable tendency. Because this is, it was a place of social solidarity. Even for a kid from an absolutely abject poverty like Jabra Ibrahim Jabra, the only school he could go to were Christian schools. And then from there he manages to get into the Arab college, and from there he goes to Cambridge. It's quite a story. But the memoir about the boyhood is vivid and in its way astonishingly happy. The unhappiness is gone. And we as readers are left to figure that out, and it doesn't require a lot of skill. But it's not a bitter memoir of victim. I only give it as an example because memory is as various as human beings are various. In a way, and maybe I shouldn't say this, but as a researcher, what you love, because it's straightforward and then easy to use or easy then to decide not to use, is something absolutely factual. I was born in, you know, Haifa. I went to such and such a school. I had a few Jewish friends. You know, I did this, but in detail. Building up a portrait, and then as a researcher you can think, that's very vivid and seems to fit in with what we know. I mean, it's example of the romanticization is the Jaffa described in Adam Labore's book, City of Oranges. Was the cosmopolitanism as wonderful as it's described in the book? Cosmopolitanism meaning not just Christians, Muslims and Jews, but Sephardic Jews, Arabic-speaking Jews from North Africa, in the early days, Ottoman and early Mandate. Not so many European Jews coming with Zionism in their minds. So the relationship is different. And not just Christian Arabs, but people from different sects and so on. No doubt there's a touch of romanticism and sentimentalism about describing the cosmopolitan Palestine, which is then destroyed, essentially by nationalism. But it's not entirely false. And compared with, I mean, let me be blunt for a second. Compared with the, today's Middle East is the antithesis in so many ways of the cosmopolitan Middle East of late 19th century, early 20th century. Even if it's been romanticized by people who lived through it, you look at the level of intolerance, violence, sectarianism, and you weep, you despair. In comparison, seen through that lens, the cosmopolitan world of Jaffa in the 1920s and 30s, or even before, but you know, yes, this then becomes a problem, the status of Jaffa vis-à-vis Tel Aviv and so on and so on. And the same could be said about the Baghdad, which some of my older friends grew up, or the Cairo. To give you only one, I'm going on far too long, but I quite deliberately chose in my Egypt chapter the story of Henri Curiel. You know about Henri Curiel? An Egyptian Jew, son of a banker, The family had been in Egypt for some generations, but they were not Egyptian in the way that an Egyptian Arab or Egyptian Egyptian Muslim or Egyptian Copt is Egyptian. He scandalizes his father at the age of 21 by learning Arabic and taking Egyptian citizenship. And he's one of the founders of the Egyptian communist movement. If you ask me in terms of agency, is he an Egyptian? You know, is he therefore worthy to be in your chapter, which is about the Egyptian struggle? My answer is yes, 100% yes. He's absolutely Egyptian. Claudia Roden, Egyptian Jew, is Egyptian. Her life's become English, as the case with no doubt many of you with Arab ancestry over the years, not by choice, really. Claudia is, the essence of her is Egyptian. And anyway, without spelling it out, without knocking it on the head with a hammer, I wanted to have, in that chapter, Gamal Abdel Nasser. I wanted, you know, the young Gamal Abdel Nasser. You know, he had a scar on his forehead from the bullet of a British soldier in one of, he was in a youthful demonstration. I never knew this. I mean, it hadn't killed him, but it had grazed his forehead. But I wanted to open up the narrative all the time. And I found a young British soldier who'd also a communist, who'd worked with Curiel in Cairo during the Second World War, and who wrote a novel about it. And I thought, wow. In other words, imperialism, the imperialists are no more one-dimensional than any other party in this very big canvas of a story, which doesn't mean imperialism is good. If you were anti-imperialist, you had virtually everything against you. In the British Army, they were allowed, communism was tolerated to a degree because Joe Stalin, Uncle Joe, was the ally in the war, you know, was against Germany. And the soldiers were allowed to have a kind of parliament, which was then closed down because this soldier and his pals were very socialist and some of them were communists. It was closed down when it called for the abolition of the monarchy in Britain and Britain's transformation into a people's republic. The British officer class thought, that's enough of soldiers' parliament. And this is lovely. Were there huge numbers? Were they hugely significant? No. But they're part of the picture, and I wanted to reclaim them, as it were, to put them back into the story, to open up people's idea. But thank you for your contribution, which is a contribution, I think, more than a question to us. How much time do we have? We probably don't.
I think we are finishing now, and I just want to say thank you so much to Roger. You should, you know, really read the book. It's really very engaging and informative. But importantly, it does provide a thesis that is quite challenging at the end that some people might take forward and think about in terms of the present, linking it to the past. So I like your kind of intellectual contribution, but also, most importantly, your very, what can I say, dogged research. I mean, this is real hard work to do this stuff. So thank you again, and thank you for being, I must say, passionate about Palestine, which is great.